For this retreat, for the Dharma talks, we're discussing a list called the Five Hindrances. And some of you who know a little bit about our Buddhist tradition knows that there are a lot of lists. And there are a lot of lists with words like hindrances, defilements, taints, corruptions, all sounding relatively negative. And to add to it, if you go to Asia, to Thailand, for example, in Burma, the teachers there will talk about these as well. And they'll talk about you have to kill the defilements. They're your enemy, and you got to... And some people here in the West find that language off-putting and find it very kind of just focusing on how negative things are. And then some people love it, destroy it. Meditate and destroy, isn't that what some people say? Down in Southern California, they say that. And Northern California, we say, meditate and accept everything. And so the divide. It's a great divide because both are true. Both are actually quite wise in their own time and place, but sometimes different people need to hear different teachings. They need to. But for the people who are troubled by the emphasis on these kind of difficult states, like the hindrances or what's sometimes in English called the defilements or all that, the Buddha, I believe he was a pretty wise person, and he was very careful not to present a spiritual path that could lead to spiritual materialism or lead to clinging or grasping to things spiritually. And so he tended to talk about the path of practice to liberation, not so much about what you attain, what you get when you get liberated or free, but rather what you become free from. So rather than focusing on, and one of the advantages of that is that if you talk about what you're supposed to attain, then people start grasping and looking and expecting and trying to manufacture and think it's supposed to be a certain way. And maybe it isn't any particular way. Maybe there is no one way that it's experienced liberation or freedom. However, to talk about what we're free from, that's something we all share, and that, if you become free of those things, then you're left without them. Then you're, you know, left without the things that are limiting. So the analogy I like is that of two people who are liberated from prison. They've been in jail for a long time, maybe equal length of time, and they just happen to be released the same day. And so their experience of the doors of the prison open, the gates opening, and then being liberated from prison is very similar. Their experience of what they're leaving behind is very similar. But once they leave prison, they go separate ways. And their experience of being free very quickly becomes very different. They go off and have different lives. And maybe both of them have good lives after that, but they're very different from each other. So what your life should look like when you become liberated, maybe you don't even know, let alone me or teachers or Buddhism. But what you become free from, we know about. Also, by focusing on the shorthand for hindrances, defilements, corruptions, taints, toxins, poisons. It's great lists, right? Great words. The shorthand for all these are the things that go ouch. The ouch factors. Ouch. And when you go to the doctor will say, where do you hurt? That's kind of like, you know, the doctor doesn't ask that sometimes, you know, it's like you go to the doctor and the doctor says, you know, well, you know, the Giants did well, and looks like they're going to do well, and what do you think? And yeah, are you a fan of the Giants, or are you someone else? And you know you only have 15 minutes for the visit, and then he goes on, she goes on to talk about the weather, and the election's coming up too. And what kind of car do you drive? You know, cars are important. It's good to have a good car, and you know, it's a good way to be safe. You know, you get a good car that has seat belts and drive safely, and you're looking at your clock. You know, you have it's down to 2 minutes left. You want the doctor to ask you, what ails you? Why are you here? You want to get focused. And so it's kind of the same way that the Buddha as a doctor, you know, is really trying to address the ouch, where the ouch is in our life. And the Buddha defined a wise person as someone who's wise, this is my paraphrasing it, someone who's wise about the ouch. Someone who's wise about how we get caught, how we limit ourselves. And as you get wiser and wiser about that, then you become less caught. There's less ouch. And then, without the ouch, then you're free to live your life in the way that seems appropriate and right to you. I think the Buddha was pretty careful, especially for lay people, lay followers, not to really tell them too much about what their life was supposed to be like, how to live. Except, you know, don't go around ouching people. Don't ouch yourself, don't ouch others. And this focus on the ouch factors, I think, can be seen also as a compassionate approach to life. That compassion is a response to suffering, to pain, to the ouch that people experience. And a compassionate person is tuned into the ouch and wants to be supportive, wants to be helpful. And it's something quite beautiful about being compassionate. You know, some of you know the Dalai Lama is going around the globe saying that if you want to be happy, be compassionate. I grew up a little bit in the psychological worlds with the term flight or fight. Flight or fight, run away or fight, turn around and fight. That's those two responses. But in recent years, people have come up with the corollary for that, which is approach and nurture. Approach and nurture. So there's something very powerful about stepping forward when it's safe, you know, approaching suffering and nurturing, meeting it. And if we can have compassion without distress, compassion without stress around it, but to actually kind of meet the suffering of ourselves, meet the suffering of others with care, compassion, goodwill, generosity. Just that is a good thing. So there's goodness in it. And it's possible to be nourished by that goodness that comes from it. I prefer to talk about goodness that we're nourished by. It turns out that scientists talk about the oxytocin that's released when you're compassionate. And so that makes it more kind of mechanical or something. But compassion is a nice thing. So the ouch factor, to tune into it, to be aware of it. So you can address it effectively, not get sidetracked from it. You can deal with the thing that's most important, that limits you, that causes pain, so that you can become free and move beyond there, so that you can awaken your compassion. I realized this only retrospectively, but in my first 5 years or so of doing Buddhist practice, unbeknownst to me and unintended by me, what was happening, and probably one of the most significant things that was happening for me in my practice, was I was being compassioned. I wasn't getting more enlightened as far as I could tell, but I was certainly getting compassioned. And that compassion came from sitting with my sufferings. And I had a lot of it. And so sitting with it, being present for it, something in my heart began to melt and open and thaw. And with that came compassion. It wasn't so conscious what was happening. It was kind of came in through the back door. And, um, And then at some point I realized, wow, those years of practice, I you know, my compassion grew dramatically. And that was very valuable. I mean, I'm very grateful for that. So to meet ourselves, so that's why, so the hindrances are one of these lists of the ouch factors. They tend to hurt. But they're sometimes very good at masking themselves. I think of them as dark holes. Like a dark hole is a place that has such strong gravitational force that light goes into the hole, black hole, the star, collapsed star, and it can't come out. So it's black. No light comes out. In the same way, the hindrances have this way of camouflaging themselves, or we get lost in them. And like sensual desire is a good one, because sometimes sensual desire has the allure of pleasure, a promise of pleasure. And sometimes it is even pleasant to have wonderful fantasies of what you want. And so it can be like you don't feel the ouch factor. Or with anger and ill will, hostility, some people even like that feeling. You're energized, it's good, and especially if you can have ill will and hate with your buddies, not towards them, but with them. Like, then it's kind of like, wow, the other team, we hate the other team, and yes, we're like good people, and it feels good. And so it camouflages the ouch factor, both for ourselves and the impact on others. Or just the fixation on the object of what we want and what we don't want is so strong that we don't really see the impact on ourselves. So it takes a while to slow down enough or be mindful enough to feel the ouch factor of it all. And coming on retreat is one of the really important and maturing, and I think really mature aspect of this kind of practice, is slowing down enough and being mindful enough that we can catch up to ourselves, and we start seeing and really recognizing what is happening here for us, and where is the ouch, what's the limitation, what's the problems, what's difficulty with some of the ways in which we operate. And starting to see our operating function, how we operate and what goes on in us, is extremely important. But for the people who are new on this, it takes a while to get your bearings. It's kind of like going into the wilderness without a map. And, if you're there long enough, maybe you'll find your way around and understand that, how to go. But at first, you have to kind of wander around and stumble around until you get a sense of it. So for people who have never been introspective, sometimes it can feel like, it's confusing and wilderness in there. But it's all good. And it takes a while. After a while, then you'll learn the terrain of how you work. And these teachings on the hindrances of how we get caught in desire, caught in ill will. Today's topic is sloth and torpor, caught in that, restlessness and anxiety, and then doubt. So start seeing how those are part of the terrain and how they work and how they function, how they limit us, is a very important part of this practice. And so don't be in a hurry to fix yourself if you happen to notice you have a hindrance. Don't feel like you have to solve it right away. Maybe there's more important things to do than solving it. Maybe the first important thing is to study it, get to know it, recognize how it works. Maybe get to know it well enough that you recognize the ouch factor, recognize how it's limiting and the shortcomings of it, how it diminishes you, or that doesn't feel good to have it, the problems with it. Because as you start seeing the limitations that these mental states have, then their allure, their enchantment, the way we kind of get fooled by them and tricked by them, is saying that they're really important. We have to have that object of desire. We're justified in having ill will to that, or whatever it is. We start kind of seeing how the magic trick is done, how we get tricked into them and believe them. And learning to see them and understand that is such an important thing. Many years ago, when I was a student at San Francisco Zen Center, there was I had a friend there, I met there, and when he first started coming to Zen Center, he lived in San Francisco, and he would come in the morning to meditate every day. But he said that he came initially to Zen Center and talked to one of the teachers there, And he explained to the teacher that he was a heroin addict. And the teacher said to him, had no judgment about him being addicted to heroin, had no kind of held him in a very wide kind of compassionate, just accepted him as he was. But he had except one thing, he had one requirement for him. He said, you have to come and meditate every morning. Now, it's a little bit wise sometimes with addicts like that, because having that regularity and that commitment, that connection can be grounding and helpful. But he didn't feel judged. He didn't feel criticized. He didn't feel like he was treated like he was a spiritual inept or anything. But he was held accountable to showing up meditating every day. And for him to be seen that way and held that way was transformative for him. And he ended up staying, becoming a regular practitioner there. And there's something about seeing ourselves whole, being complete, not fragmenting ourselves or being divided against ourselves. That's a very important part of this process. And one of the things that the hindrances tend to do is they tend to divide us. They tend to fragment us. We don't really see the forest. We see maybe some of the trees, but we don't really see the fullness of who we are. And sometimes it's very helpful to not be so fixated and focused on the details of the particular issue that's going on right now that we have, but kind of metaphorically step back and kind of like you're having a bird's eye view or a distant view, step back far enough you can see yourself as whole, as the entirety of yourself. And whatever the entirety is really meaningful for you at that time, it could be the entirety of that moment and all the different aspects that are going on. It could be the entirety of your life and your life experience and your communities that you lived in and you came from and your ancestors, your family, and just whatever kind of makes you whole, makes you see your entirety of who you are. How far do you have to step back so you can hold it all? Because it's easy, you know, if... it's so easy, and I think all of you know, to get so caught in the particular detail of the moment. You know, so, you know, you're in the dining room, and you drop your plate on the floor full of food right next to the buffet table, and it splats all over, and it shatters, and Ruth is standing there. The teacher, maybe I'm standing there, everyone's looking, and at that moment, you know, like all kinds of reactions can go on in your head, you know, and some of the hindrances come rushing in, and fear and dread, and what does this mean, and people won't like me, or maybe they realize I'm not really that mindful after all, and I'll be asked to leave. The first time I overslept at the Zen monastery in the morning, I was convinced they were going to expel me from the monastery. I was absolutely convinced this is it. And there was two periods of meditation in the morning. I think we started, I think, at, I don't know when, 4:30 in the morning or something, real early. So we did two periods, and I overslept the first one. And I thought, oh no, they're going to kick me out. But I did go to the second one, and I was waiting all day. I was waiting for the... waiting for the news, Gil. And to my surprise, no one ever said anything to me. So I'm trying to point out is that you get caught in the detail of the moment, and we think this moment defines us as who we are. This is like the big drama of the moment, the plate, you know. But what happens if you step back and take the big picture of yourself? And would you relate to that in the moment differently, yourself and differently? How would you hold it if you open up widely? So what I'm trying to kind of point to is also with the hindrances. If you get caught in desire, caught in aversion, caught in sloth and torpor, sometimes you don't want to see it right away as a problem. But maybe you can step back and kind of see it, see yourself more in the entirety of yourself and your life in some broad way. And what would that look like? What would you have to? What do you see if you see the entirety of yourself? You see the difficult. You see the good. You see your intention, you see the struggles, you see what you're up against, you see many, many things. And can you, how far do you have to step back to see the entire picture well enough that you can hold it kindly, so you can hold it with compassion, that you can hold it lightly, just let it be there, without maybe taking it so personally and caught in the details of it. And it is one of the instructions we sometimes give people, especially if they're caught in very strong emotions like anger or with fear, is to ask people to imagine themselves, you know, if they stood on the hill behind here, could they then, is it okay then to hold the fear, be present for the fear? Some people, no, that's too far, that's too close. It's too close. Well then, how about if you go, you know, up the block? Or, you know, no, it's still too close. Well, how about if you're like on the other side of Santa Cruz County? Well, I think if I was on the other side of Santa Cruz County, then I could probably stay present for my fear. It's great. Just imagine you're that far away and just kind of from a distance, just get the binoculars and that counts for a lot, to go back far enough to imagine yourself that kind of bird's eye view, so then you can be with it without reacting. So to step back, to be able to see it, open to it, and not, you know, just let it be. It's kind of like stepping back far enough so you can see the forest instead of just getting caught in the trees. But I like to use a different analogy. Step back far enough so you can see the orchard instead of the apple tree. And sometimes that's what you see, the whole orchard, and it's like, okay, there's all kinds of trees, and this is how it is. And most people don't look at a forest or an orchard or even an individual tree, like these oak trees here and redwood trees. And, you know, I think it's twisting the wrong way. I think the branches aren't quite right. You know, they're not quite symmetrical. I think branches should be a little different. A good tree should have branches in different places. And, you know, I don't know if the oak should be that way. And, you know, let it be. We see it. A little meandering, but maybe it's okay. When I was a young kid, child and adolescent, I used to wonder about what was a successful life? And my answer was, I'll only know on my deathbed. And whatever life I had, that will have been successful. But I can't know beforehand. But I can know after looking back. Isn't that nice? Whatever life I had, that's what a human life is about. Just like that's the way a tree is. You know, why? You know, so I kind of, okay, so I don't know, but I'll find out. So we step back and we look at the orchard, we look at the entirety. But sometimes, that's support to be non-reactive, to learn how to be at peace, to be at ease. It's okay, be compassionate, okay. Hold this without making much to do about it. Just there, see it for what it is. And then sometimes in practice, it's good to go get closer. And sometimes it's appropriate to not just see the whole orchard, but to see the individual apple tree. And see the apple tree. This is an apple tree, and just see that, see it clearly for what it is. So sometimes you don't just look at your whole entirety, but you actually come in closer and you look more, if a hindrance is there, you actually look more closely at it and you see it for itself. You see the apple tree for itself, you see it, and the apple tree-ness of the apple, you see it. Sometimes you want to get closer and just see the hindrance in and of itself as it is. And but it's ideally you'd see it as a natural phenomenon. It just, it's the tree in your mind. It's a tree that just, you know, it's a natural thing that just exists. And you just allow it to be there without hopefully taking it personally, hopefully without being for or against it, but just kind of learn to see it. And then sometimes you can get even closer to the apple tree. And you don't just see the apple tree, but now you look at a leaf, and you see the leaf for itself. Or you look at the apple that's growing there, and you just see the apple for itself. And you see the appleness of the apple. So you can, sometimes you can get closer and just see. It's really nice to see some of the details. It's nice to see the whole orchard. It's nice to see the tree. It's nice just to really kind of take in the particular apple. So the same thing with the hindrances. You know, you say that I have caught up in desire, or say I have caught up in ill will, is kind of abstract, but you actually kind of see the details of it, that you have a particular kind of desire, and it has a certain kind of energy in the body, and certain contraction and tightness, and a certain kind of energy in the mind, and certain beliefs that go with it. And you start seeing some of the details of how it works for you, these things. So you start, you know, you're looking in more closely. And some people tend to kind of look at things more generally or abstractly, there's desire, and that's nice, but sometimes you want to kind of go closer and really kind of, what are the thoughts, what are the beliefs, what are the feelings, emotions that are there, what are the body sensations, kind of get closer. And then, you know, you see the apple, and there's a great thing about apples, I don't know if you know this, that when they get ripe enough, really ripe, they'll fall off the tree by themselves. But when they're almost ripe, or you know, just on the edge of being ripe, I guess, or you know, they are ripe, you can actually come from underneath and you gently lift the apple up a little bit from the stem, and if it comes off, then it's ripe and ready to eat. But if you have to pull it, it's not quite ready yet. So you can go up to the apple and feel the different ones, you find one that comes off easily. But if you pull it off, you know, it doesn't really ripen properly, maybe, I don't know, maybe sometimes they keep ripening afterwards, but I can imagine then you're tearing it off the tree in the poor tree. So here you are with your hindrance. You see, you know, not only have a this particular thing, but you see there's a certain attitude or belief or something you're holding on to that's connected to it. And it'll fall from the tree, it'll fall away when the time is right, if you get to know it, if you're present for it. It's tremendous power, just learning to be mindful, non-reactive mindful, just being present for it, letting it have its time to ripen so that it can fall off and fall away. Almost all things which are that have ouch factors in them will fall away, dissolve, if we hold them clearly for a while in awareness. Sometimes it's longer than we wish, but we have to hold them for a while. But it's okay to get so close sometimes that you can help it off. So you come and lift it off and say, you can go now. Bye-bye. I'll let go of you. And if it falls off then you know it was ripe, ready to go. But if you have to yank it and pull it and push it away and it, you know, and you kind of use force and aggression and it comes right back and all that, then it probably wasn't ripe to let go of. You weren't ready. It wasn't ready to be let go of. And maybe, as I say earlier, you know, the Dharma knows what you need. You don't know when the right time is, when it's really proper to let go. And so you don't want to force the issue. And it's in any case, it's much better to let go of things once you know them well. And so don't be in a hurry to let go. Take your time. So patience in this meditation practice, a lot of patience. Training yourself, learning to come back and just be here in a simple way. Just be here and look. Be here and be with what is. And learn that art, learn the skill, the contemplative skill of just kind of being present for whatever is here for you without it needing a lot of things to change or become something or get somewhere. Just to be. And then get to know it as you do that. Getting to know it doesn't mean you're thinking about it and analyzing it. It means that you're just listening deeply like you would listen to music in a symphony, or you know, any kind of music. You know, you're usually not analyzing which notes and, you know, was that a half note or a full note they just did? A quarter note? You know, you don't analyze the music, you just take it in. So the same thing, we just take in, experience it, what goes on. Contemplative kind of just being. As we do this, though, sometimes we run into sloth and torpor. And sloth and torpor is a very interesting phenomenon. So if you knew how interesting it was, you would get me energized. Now, sometimes sloth and torpor comes together with the first two hindrances, because frustrated desire can lead to giving up, to being deflated, to and frustrated aversion. Or the other thing is, if you're caught up in desire all the time, or caught up in ill will and anger all the time, that's exhausting too. So chronic desire, chronic fear, chronic aversion is stressful and exhausting. And so the whole system kind of gets exhausted from that. So the other thing that can happen when we stop and do this contemplative practice of just being and not trying to attain and get and do all these things is that when the mind has been used to, it's been fueled by desire or fueled by ill will and anger, it's kind of like caffeine. And as long as you're fueled by caffeine, you can keep going perhaps. But if you stop taking caffeine, there's often a transition time. Some people say it takes 3 days to go through the transition with headaches and feeling kind of off. So sometimes people are so dependent on getting energized and using the energy of desire or ill will to keep themselves going that when they stop, there's a transition time and sloth, torpor, dullness, aching, restlessness begin to setting in. So that can happen on these retreats. So sometimes a sloth and torpor comes from, if we're not continuing with the desire mode or the aversive mode that's so common maybe in daily life, and we're kind of letting go of it and just being simple, we end up with this transition period we have to go through as we kind of clear out and come back to a more natural state. There are many reasons for getting lethargic on retreat, getting lethargic in life, drained of our energy, unenergetic, fatigued, exhausted, tired, whatever the words are that you like, in a stupor. When we talk about sloth and torpor, we're not talking about tiredness, and we're not talking about physical exhaustion that just comes from working a lot, or mental exhaustion that comes from doing a lot of mental work. Those things need rest, and rest is good. But what we're talking about is something that comes from more of an attitude. It comes from when there's plenty of energy available. And so some of you know this, that I call sloth and torpor my seer's mind. Because when I was a kid, my mom would take me clothes shopping at Sears. Oh, some of you too? to say it mildly, to use polite language maybe, I didn't like it. And as soon as we go into Sears and the smell of it and the idea of what we're doing there, boy, was I tired. I was really tired. Oh, so hard. I don't have the energy. I can't. But then, after we'd finished doing this really tedious thing, then my mother would sometimes suggest we go out for ice cream. I was alert, clear as a bell, energized. My posture changed. Yes. I had plenty of energy. The sloth and torpor was an attitude, was resistance, was feeling defeated, I don't want to do this thing. It wasn't what I wanted to do. Someone else was controlling me. All these different things going on that it was a strategy for how to deal with challenge. So it wasn't ordinary tiredness, it was a strategy. Or an attitude of being deflated somehow. And there's a good reasons for it. I mean, in daily life, in the world out there, I mean, it's so easy to feel so discouraged and defeated and just give up. I mean, there's society provides us with so many challenges sometimes, and our life circumstances are so difficult, and the way people treat each other and ongoingly can be so exhausting, and you know, to feel like, well, you've done the good fight for a while, but to just be worn down by it. And in that kind of giving up, sloth and torpor gives up, lethargy comes in, because, you know, it is an attitude, but it's one that makes sense given that, you know, all your efforts are not being successful. And so we come on retreat sometimes with all these attitudes about effort, about what we're trying to do, about when someone tells us, gives us instruction, what to do, that sometimes the legacy, the history of how we've lived in our society comes into play here, and those attitudes come back and play here too. And people will be lethargic, and kind of, or sloth and torpor will come in, or they get drained, or they give up, or they get dull. And so sloth and torpor is something to study, look at, oh, look at there. And be very careful with all the hindrances to not be fooled by them. And the way we get fooled by them is to look away from them or to accept them as a given. Oh, I just have sloth and torpor. I'm just tired. This is just how it is. But rather to look at them as something to study, to be present for, to investigate, to be with. So with sloth and torpor, sloth is physical tiredness, this kind of lethargy, and torpor, I understand, is the mental side of it. And is there an attitude that's come into play? Is there resistance? Is there discouragement? Is there a sense of being defeated? Is there beliefs like, this is too hard, I can't do it? That kind of are draining your energy, draining you away, your enthusiasm. Is there discouragement because you had an expectation that it should be different, and when you're up against trying to attain your expectation, and you just doesn't happen, then there's a feeling kind of just, I give up, or this is too hard, and so kind of a collapsing of energy, of the mind shuts down, the mind gets dull. You know, just, so what's going on there? To look and see what's happening there. And and one of the ways, important way to do that is to always, almost everything we do here in the mindfulness practice, is keep coming back and looking at it in your body. The body. The body is like the foundation for our life. It's where our life is lived. It's the temple. It's the sacred ground. It's the support system. It's our friend. Come back. Wait. So how does sloth and torpor, what does it feel like in the body? Where is it? Where do you feel? If it's in the mind, where does that swamp mind reside? What does it feel like? Dull, heavy, closed down. Feels like, thick mud you're trying to make your way through. What does it feel like? To be curious and go into it. Go into it as close as you can. Like you're going into, as far into, kind of, you're really going to touch and hold that apple and lift it up. Go in there and really feel. What is it actual physical sensations like for you of having sloth and torpor? And then it's good to do a little bit of evaluation, a little bit of analysis, teeny bit, to see, what is this? Is this really ordinary tiredness? Or is this some kind of attitude or some kind of what's happening? Because it's normal to get tired. and so at the end of the day, you're end of the afternoon, you're tired, and you go through a dip. And so you're not so dull, you're kind of dull and not so clear, and it's hard to practice. That's not necessarily sloth and torpor, that's just ordinary tiredness that you have to just practice through, and maybe take a nap if you can. Or is it kind of a physical exhaustion? Some people practice as if they have to kind of go all out all the time. But mindfulness and meditation is a kind of mental work. And you sometimes need to be to regenerate. And so you don't want to just go, you know, run the marathon all the time. You know, it's going, sometimes you need to take a break. And part of the function of alternating between sitting and walking is to provide a little alternation in what the mind does and is involved in, so the mind can kind of rest from one activity and before it does the next, and come back a little bit more kind of renewed to do another round. Or the after lunch or after a meal, sit and have tea and look out over the, you know, our orchard, not ours, but across the street. Maybe that's what's needed to kind of refresh and come back in a more refreshed way. And so to look at sloth and torpor, you feel the tiredness you feel, and try to distinguish the best you can between what's going on there. And sometimes you have to take care of yourself by getting some rest, taking a break. But sometimes what you have is you have these deeply seated attitudes that are draining, they're debilitating. And it's hard to see. That's kind of the nature of sloth and torpor. You're so much sloth that you can't even make the effort to look at it itself. So there are a number of things you can do to get a little more energy. But as you try to get more energy with sloth and torpor, try not to have the attitude, I'm going to, you know, blow the sloth and torpor out of the way so I can have, you know, pristine, perfect energy and clarity and just, you know, on my way to nirvana by this afternoon. But rather, try to get enough energy so you can, at first, so you can study and look more deeply at what's going on. Not the kind of looking that gets your mind thinking a lot, but actually the kind of looking that helps the mind get quieter. So to look, as I said earlier, where is it in the body? Kind of like, what is this? You can ask the question, what is this? And don't think an answer, feel an answer. What does this feel like? You know, if you kind of have a silent mind, look at it, hear it, feel it. So you can get quieter as you're present for it. No need to think, you know, beyond a certain, you know, rudimentary point. And so how to get energized a little bit so you can do this more effectively? You can open your eyes when you meditate. You can walk a little bit faster if you're walking. You can sit up straighter, and you can sit up quite straight sometimes, and the effort and energy to sit up can help. If you use the mental noting, you can note a little bit more vigorously, take more energy. Like, even if you use mental notes, silent notes in your mind, you can note louder in your head. You know, you don't have to scream, but so there's more energy in it. Or some people will actually note more quickly, more notes per minute, and pick up the. How many you do, just to get more energy in there, and that sometimes brings the energy to kind of focus more. Sometimes, as I said earlier, you could stand in here if that's helpful. If you're sitting in a chair, be careful with chairs because it's very easy to get too comfortable. Maybe you don't believe me, if you've been there for a few days now, I remember once I sat a 3-month retreat and I was pretty good. I was coming out of my Zen time, and so I was like always sitting this way. And after about 2 months or so, I thought, you know, it's probably a good idea for my body to give it a little bit of a break and try a different posture whatever strain was building up can kind of not always be sitting this way. So there was a little kind of lounge in the retreat center and a couch on the side. So I thought, great, I'll just sit and meditate on the couch. And so during that period of meditation, I sat there on the couch, and it was the fastest meditation session I've ever done in my life. It seemed like it was over just when I started. I'd fallen asleep. I slept happily until the bell rang. So there's something about, you know, just leaning back in the couch. So you have to be a little bit careful about your posture, how you sit, and sloth and torpor, it can be easy to want to give in to the comfort of, you know, oh yes, you know, but you have to be careful with that if what you're trying to do is to have enough energy to pay attention to the look. The other thing that can be helpful is to renew or strengthen or remind yourself of your intention to practice. Your intention is one of your great supports for practice. And sometimes with sloth and torpor, part of the reason is the topic can go on is we're not really sure why we're doing this, and the sense of purpose is lacking, and what was that about, and why am I here, and what am I supposed to be doing, and why should I follow my breath, and you know, in Santa Cruz I could be surfing, why am I here, and so. But to kind of check in with yourself, what's your intent? Is there an intention? What is your intention to practice? And can you get behind it? In Buddhism, the activities that you're involved in are referred to as being noble. It's a noble endeavor. It's a dignified endeavor that you're engaged in. And it's really worthwhile. It's one of the, I believe, one of the greatest things you can do for our society. Right after 9/11, a week later, a couple that I knew were going off to do a 3-month retreat at IMS, and I made the point to go find them and said, you know, you might think that in the wake of 9/11, that going off by yourself, you know, on a retreat and silent, away from society, away from the traumatized world that we had and the great needs that we had, that this is maybe not the right time, not the right thing. It's too selfish or too self-absorbed or something. And I said, no. In times like this, we really need to have people. This is a response to it. We really need some people who now more than ever, who really are delving deep into themselves to get to the roots of their greed, hate, and delusion, gets to the root of how we operate, what goes on, to clarify and free and liberate. Because someone has to show us that it's possible. Someone has to do this work. It's not just about taking care of the world around us. Sure, certainly we take care of it, but someone has, you know, there's a possibility for freedom in there, at the root of our being. And so maybe that's how I'm here. You know, it's a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's a noble thing. What's your intention? What is your intention? Just the fact that, you know, your life is important. And how you live your life and what your life is about is important. If you can really drop into your heart and discover what your intention is, that's important. And if you don't know what your intention is, the intention to find out is important. Your intention to find out is beautiful. You know, or you can just watch TV. You know, but that's not noble, I would think. So getting behind your intention, being renewing it, remembering it, is one of these ways to kind of somehow come out of the sloth and torpor enough that you can come back to practice and engage and look at it and evaluate and see what's going on. And then if the apple is ripe, it's okay to pluck it off, and it's okay to let go of the attitude, the belief, the limitation that you have when you're kind of there draining you or debilitating you or doing this. But look and see what's going on. What evaluation, what judgment, what expectation, what disappointment, what discouragement, what boredom it might be going on. But don't expect you're going to find an answer to these questions always, because, you know, if it's sloth and torpor because you're no longer using the caffeine of desire and aversion or the caffeine of fear, maybe it's just a transition time, and you just have to learn how to be gracious with the transition time. Or sometimes things become very vague in meditation practice. You can't quite do the mindfulness practice. It's kind of like things are just kind of seem kind of dull or vague or cloudy, or can't quite be with what's going on. And it doesn't necessarily mean there's a problem whatsoever with your practice. It could be that it's a different kind of transition than the caffeine transition. You're just between states. You're between different stages of what happens in the practice. And so then it's just to be gracious with that. Practice the best you can. Don't make it worse than it needs to be. Don't add a second arrow. Let it just be. And just learn to practice with that. The idea of learning to practice with what is I think, one of the greatest things you can do for your life. Whatever you're given, whatever the circumstance you find yourself in, to try to, how do I practice with this? How do I meet this? Let's be mindful of this. As opposed to, not this. Let's see if I can get rid of this so that then I can really practice. If only this wasn't happening, then I could practice. If only my knee, my back, my head didn't hurt, then I could really do this. I'd be a great yogi, nirvana by the afternoon. But there's this issue, there's this hindrance, there's this lethargy, there's this whatever. And you don't need to think that way. You can say, oh, so now this is happening. So now, let me, metaphorically maybe, let me sit up straight. And let me look it right in the eye. Let me practice with this. Let me be with this now clearly. And if you need to back off and be up on the hill to see the entire thing, to see yourself as whole, step back. If you need to step forward and just see the apple, step forward and get closer. But you know, sit upright, metaphorically, kind of, and be free. In the very effort to see and to meet, to be present for this thing, for this breath, this step, for this desire, for this tiredness, for this ache. Right there, you can find freedom, because it's you that's stepping forward. I'm here. I'm going to be present for this, rather than being weighed down by it or pushed around by it. Right there in the mindfulness and the awareness that you apply, you can find freedom. Your freedom does not depend on anything disappearing. Your freedom depends on how you meet it. And meeting it with awareness, meeting it with mindfulness, is one of the great forms of freedom. If this seems like a very foreign idea to you, that there's freedom found in awareness, freedom found in mindfulness, experiment a little bit. Experiment with your attention, your awareness, of how you're aware of different things, and see, can you find a place where the mind is upright, or the awareness is upright and stable and dignified and independent of what it knows. So the final thing I'll say is that someone who matures in this practice, the Buddha described as someone who has become independent in the Dharma. Become independent in the Dharma. We're still connected to everyone, we're interdependent with everyone in a certain way, but there's a certain way in which the heart, the mind, the awareness has become independent, can stand on its own in the midst of whatever is happening at the moment, as difficult or as easy as it might be. It's an experiment. Well, what is this? You can't do it in all times, in all situations, but what is this? What did Gil mean? Be free or independent in being aware, in being mindful. So, You know, we were getting kind of close to midway through the retreat, and I had some doubts, which is what we're going to talk about that in a couple of days. But I was I was a little bit ahead of the game. I had some doubts about the wisdom of talking about sloth and torpor at this point in the retreat. I didn't want to be suggestive. I didn't want to dampen, you know, your enthusiasm, what you're up with. But I just want to I want to say that express my appreciation of you. Express my appreciation for your practice and what you're doing here, and appreciation of what you're working with in yourself. And I know that from the inside, you might feel like you're floundering or struggling or something, but it's really a wonderful thing you're doing. And you're not just doing it for yourself, you do it for the world. And I have a tremendous admiration and respect for what you're doing. You guys are all doing great. And don't let a talk on sloth and torpor get in the way of your intention. And I would encourage you to kind of give yourself over to the retreat. Give yourself over to your practice. Protect your practice. Safeguard it well. And if there's some way that you can appropriately give yourself over more wholeheartedly to the practice here, it's a great thing to do. And for some certain phases of practice, or in phases of the retreat, phases of a person's life, one of the ways to give yourself over more fully to it is to slow down a bit as you go around the retreat center. Not to force yourself to slow down, but to slow down so that you can be present more fully for what's going on. So go a bit down the steps a little bit slower to, you know, just do whatever, do everything slow, except don't let the lunch line back up too much. Slow down so you can maybe kind of really be with what is in a fuller way, more complete way. So let's finish with a gathering ourselves together back into the practice mode.